Okay, thank you everybody for joining us today. Emma, thank you for that introduction on behalf of Martha and myself. We thank everybody for being here and thank you for giving us this opportunity to share something that both Martha and I are passionate about in different ways. Bringing it together, we hope, is really going to bring more information to everybody in the room. That's pretty much our goal. Martha does it through treating people in her practice. She'll talk about herself in a second. I do it through college teaching and phone calls and my cell phone and connections with rabbis. And our goal is just to help women committed to Taharas Mishpacha, helping them navigate the world of their health and halacha together in the midst of Taharas Mishpacha while understanding medically what's happening to them and taking care of themselves. Like I said, I'm Tammy Drapkin. I was a college teacher since I don't remember what year she said, so whatever she said, that's how long it's been. Martha, you can.
I work currently as a women's health nurse practitioner with a private practice associated both in downtown Chicago and Northbrook. I see women of all ages, so that's, I would say, my professional path. And then I feel like in the community, I do a lot more lactation education and childbirth education, and happy to be a resource with the college teachers in our community, who is a tremendous resource for everyone in this stage. So we're excited to be here. Thank you.
And the two plugs, just because get them out of the way, is one, you can reach me through my cell phone or through the hotline. The COLA has an anonymous hotline. You can reach it through the handouts are in the folder. The bulletin board is out there. There are five college teachers on the hotline. Someone is always at the phone. We don't always call back. We don't always answer right away, but if you leave a message, somebody will get back to you. It's anonymous. The whole thing is anonymous. Texting, calling, email, web form, everything is anonymous, confidential, and the goal is just to get any woman who asks a question the answer she's looking for, the answer she needs, the answer and more information about her question. And Martha, I just highly recommend everyone find her. That's all I can say. Find her for anything and everything you need. You will be better off. That's all I can say. Okay. We titled it today, The Top 5 Life Cycle Events and Their Impact on Medicine and Halacha. Based on the timing and after our research, we brought it down to 4, which means that we'll make it in time for lunch. So we are very mindful that you have been learning all morning, and lunch is right after us. That's an important part. Okay. The background and why the Kollel does this every so often and why it's so important to know about people like Martha in the community and why we bring up this topic over and over and over again is because life is happening. Questions are coming up. As life changes, as life moves forward, things change. Our bodies change. Your doctor, your nurse, your medical practice is there to help with the medical as you take care of yourself, as bodies change, as life changes. And so, too, as you update your health care and you take care of yourself health-wise, halacha changes, too. Now, the back part, and any kala teacher loves to say this, like, we often get accused from our kalas who we love, you didn't teach me that. You are correct. I didn't teach you that because when you were about to get married, it wasn't really the time to teach you about menopause. You weren't listening. It wasn't interested to you. So you are correct. I did not teach you that. So that comes up. So what I try to remind my colleagues as I teach them is that it's like, and I don't mean to minimize it so much, and they don't like hearing it, but it's really true. We're learning the letters right now. When you learn to read, you start with A, you start with B, you start with C, you move on to second grade, you're putting the words together, you move on to sentences, and like by fourth grade you're reading chapter books, and then like seventh grade you make it to Harry Potter. I mean, like, you just keep moving along, and your knowledge and your experience becomes wider, becomes more extensive. Halacha and Taharas Mishpacha is the same way. We teach our kalas the very basics, the very beginning, because that's what's appropriate at that point in time. But the biggest message I can give to every woman in the room is as life goes on, as your journey continues, as life happens and your body continues to change, because that's how Hashem made the world, halacha is available to you as well. The only way to access that is definitely through lots of books, a lot of learning, yarchei kalas, and when something specific comes up in your own personal life. As I've said, at every single shiur I've given, any time I give it, is ask the shiloh for yourself. Find out what the halacha is for you. I've been told there are more svarim written about Taharas Mishpacha than there are for Shabbos and Kashrut. And we all know how much time we spend thinking about Shabbos and Kashrut. So Taharas Mishpacha has a lot of halacha available. If a woman doesn't ask, she won't get her answer. She won't get the information. And we are so blessed in today's world to have so many resources to have access to that information. Websites, the Neely Hotline, Martha can help you get it. I'm around, all the college teachers. There are so many organizations available today. All I want to do is encourage women to get information both medically and halakhically to navigate through this world of Taharas Mishpacha in their life. So that's the background to how this session came about, just bringing you more information as much as we can. Like I just said, it's very obvious that when you go to your doctor, you ask for, you know, when you see, tell your doctor your specific symptoms, you don't really care what the textbook says about what the options are for what it could be. You want to know what is happening in your body. What is your personal medical diagnosis at that time? So too, halacha is the same. You bring your situation, you bring your realities, you bring your experience, you bring your medical information that you got from your doctor or your nurse and that you know, and then you put all that into the shaila, into the question, and it is synthesized, so to speak, to get you a halacha psak. And that's also our goal here. We're talking about the point at which medicine and halacha overlap. It is not black and white. It is not simple, and it is not universal. What it is personal, and it is complex. So every woman who's committed to taking care of herself medically and committed to the mitzvah of Taharas Mishpacha, it is incumbent upon each woman who's doing it to find out her as much information as she can so that she will be able to make an informed decision. Go learn from your medical provider what is happening. Ask the questions. Bring that to your Rav or whoever you're bringing your Shaila to. And those two together, and it's a lot to learn, and it's a lot of information to gather, and there's no easy way to do it. We're getting better. Rabbis know a lot more. We have so many medical professionals in the Chicagoland area who know so much about halakha, so we have made tremendous progress. But there's no simple, easy situation, but there's no easy way right now just to type in and get it easily answered. It is extremely personal. It is extremely specific. So every woman who researches and get herself informed medically brings us the halachic shayla. She will then get a psak for herself in that area. And I think that is really our push and our emphasis for the day. Okay, that's the introduction. Disclaimers.
Yeah,
I have to disclaimers. I am not a posek. I don't act like one. I don't pretend to be one. It's a joke. But I am very happy and very honored to bring your personal shaila to a Rav who will be able to process it, ask more detailed questions, and get you your psak for you.
My disclaimer is that we're going to talk about a lot of different cases that come up throughout the life cycle, and you might picture yourself in the shoes of some of the women that we're going to discuss from a very hypothetical standpoint. These are not you. I don't know your medical history. I'm not here to give you personal medical advice today. So please don't take anything from today's program to change your health without first talking to your healthcare provider.
Okay, moving on, and great. I see we're running out of time already.
No, go for it.
The first question, many of the questions that we get, either at the hotline or just as a college teacher, is always about birth control. Staining from birth control, the timing of birth control, whether it's a Kala trying to time her cycle around her wedding, a postpartum woman trying to get to the mikvah while she's nursing, a woman getting an IUD put in, and the questions, the needed questions around that. Everyone understands what birth control is clearly, but can you tell us how it works in the body, what the various options are, and why staining happens so much from it?
Yes, so before we even go to what we call birth control or the pill, I just want everyone to have a brief overview of a normal textbook person's normal menstrual cycle and what happens. So essentially, just so we can understand moving forward all the different options, let's picture a woman who starts her period on day one of her cycle. That's the first day of her cycle. And typically, during that first half of the cycle, the ovaries and the body are getting prepped for ovulation. They're getting ready to release an egg. And that's predominantly under the influence of a hormone called estrogen that our bodies make. Then, day 14 or 16, middle of the cycle, the egg gets dropped out, waits to get fertilized, waits to get pregnant. If that doesn't happen, then a woman gets her period again. And in that second half of the cycle, estrogen and progesterone are working together to build up the uterine lining, to get the uterus ready for a baby, hopefully. And then if there is no fertilization, everything kind of drops down hormone-wise and then withdrawals and signals to your body to bleed and shed. So that is a normal fluctuation of a woman's menstrual cycle. We are never, I always have patients that come and say, oh, can you like check my hormones? Like something's off. I could check your hormones, but it's going to be depending on where you are in your cycle that it's going to fluctuate. So no one definition of normal levels of anything from a medical standpoint makes much sense. That being said, a birth control pill is a really wonderful option for people, A, to prevent pregnancy. And the reason why it works is that it is a it delivers a steady state of hormone, preventing this cycling that happens in a woman. And when we don't have the negative feedback and the cycling that occurs, it prevents ovulation, prevents pregnancy. It also can treat symptoms associated with someone's menstrual cycle. So maybe that's cramping, bloating, acne, skin changes, mood changes, sleep changes. Those could all happen from the joys of being a woman from someone's cycle. So a birth control pill is also an approved treatment, even in unmarried women, for such symptoms. So when we talk about putting a Kala or putting a woman who wants to space children or anyone in their life on a birth control pill, essentially we're preventing ovulation or preventing pregnancy through 3 weeks. Typically, if you picture a birth control pack, it's four rows of pills, each with 7 days. You take one every single day of the month. 3 weeks contain hormone, typically. 1 week does not. That placebo week mimics the fall in hormone that occurs and triggers your body to shed the uterine lining. That is not a true period per se as a response to ovulation, but it's this like fabricated withdrawal bleed that we give a woman so that she feels normal. Us people in the 21st century like to get a period and know we're not pregnant or know that the body is functioning normal, but essentially it's a placeholder. So back to questions I get a lot from Kala teachers, people are always asking about, does that week really matter? And medically it doesn't. So.
And can I double pack? Can I triple pack? Can I quadruple pack? Do I need to get a period? And I always say ask the doctor, because it's up to the doctor, medical provider, to understand medically if that's allowed. How
Yeah, so basically that placebo week is really a break in the hormone. Data obviously has shown us that 7 day break from after 21 days of active hormone is still effective for contraception and preventing pregnancy, but it will trigger that withdrawal bleed. That withdrawal bleed is not medically necessary because the stabilization of the hormones in the first half of the pack are preventing the buildup of the lining to an extent that a fertile and cycling woman would experience. So technically, from a medical perspective, no one ever has to take their placebo weeks. You can go straight from active pack to active pack to active pack in a row without withdrawing or without allowing for that 7 day break. That being said, every body is different. So some people will notice after they cycle two or three packs in a row, they start staining. They might have some breakthrough bleeding. And that's just the female body who is, the uterine lining is ready for a little bit of a shed. And typically the treatment for the staining is to allow that full 7 days of a withdrawal bleed and then to restart. So from a medical perspective, it is safe to skip the placebo week and essentially skip your periods. And for some people that notice symptoms that come on their birth control pack only during the placebo week, they can skip those weeks to skip those symptoms, and oftentimes they feel a whole lot better. So that's a perk of skipping.
And the fun part is, halakhically, there's no mitzvah to get a period. You don't have to. These mitzvot come into play when a woman menstruates, when she sheds the lining. You do not have to halakhically get a cycle. You do not have to. However, this is when all the questions come up. If a woman does double pack or triple pack or however many packs she does, like Martha said, sometimes there will be some staining. There might be some shedding. She might not be able to make it a whole year of 12 packs in a row. So the biggest issue with double packing, triple packing, multiple packing, we'll call it, which is a phrase I think I just made up, but maybe not, okay, is that what's the staining situation? So this is a speech that every college teacher has repeated over and over and over and over and over and over again. I think most people here have heard it, but I'm going to give it one more time. That halacha does not see every drop of blood from the uterus as nida. It is blood from the uterus. It is not nida blood from the uterus. There's a very specific standard and halachic guidelines for what creates the status of nida. The status that we know that we commonly call nida is the obvious, a woman's menstrual cycle. There are two elements to her cycle that make it nida. One is the timing. She's expecting it. It's that time of the month is part of a natural cycle or a period cycle. She's expecting it, so the timing of it, and the flow, the amount. It has to be a flow. According to halacha, that is what makes a woman a nida. Her monthly flow with those two elements, the amount and the timing. If a woman is missing one of those two, all of a sudden, what happens now? We have a status of some uterine blood, but it doesn't have all those elements. Okay, it is not her monthly flow. Let's say in between her flows, she sees stains, which is the most common question. And this is very natural, very part of the human experience, very part of the woman's experience. Our bodies do things. So halacha recognizes that. We are not machines. We do not just neatly have a cycle once a month and call it a day. There's a lot of action and activity in between. What is the halachic status of all that staining? So halacha comes and says, okay, the monthly flow that the woman is expecting at her right time, that is clearly nida. The staining in between, the blood that might be seen in between, the other bodily fluids that might be seen in between, some will cause nida and some will not. There are criteria that needs to be met for those stains to cause nida. We have now moved the first category that I described of a woman's cycle, we're going to call it the flow. When it's expected and it's a lot, that is her monthly flow. That's the category of flow. Flow makes a woman a nida. There's another category that may or may not make a woman a nida, and that is called staining. For any, or in Hebrew, a ketem, as they call it in halacha, any staining to cause nida has to meet a certain amount of criteria. Criteria number one is that it has to be seen. If the stain was not seen, it was not there. Now, there is no woman who can honestly experience a period and not see it. Like, that's not a thing that's real, and we don't rely on it. We rely on human experience of a woman taking care of herself. But if it's a slight stain, a slight smidgen, she might not see it. So number one, the stain has to be seen. Number two, it has the color. The color of the stain has to be a questionable or a nida color, which is reds or blacks or dark browns. Again, you know, I'm a mower by training, so I always talk about the box of Crayola crayons has a lot of browns and reds in it. You can spend a lot of time on those. And the Rabbanim are trained. That's why they're trained in the nuances of the different colors. Some of it is a sore on the inside of the vaginal canal. Some of it is actually uterine bleeding. Some of it is old uterine bleeding that's residual, and it's not nida. So the color of the stain is going to be a big deal. A light color, a super light brown, a yellow, that's not nida. That's not a question. So it has to be a nida color. So first it has to be seen. Then it has to be the nida color. Then it also has to be big enough. And the size that halacha gives is the size of a gris, which is the size of about a U.S. penny. If it comes out bright, and it's about what the woman sees. If a woman sees a stain smaller than a gris, and this is a joke I've made over and over again, if it comes out with a sign that says, I am red and from the uterus, but it is smaller than a gris, she can ignore it. It is insignificant if she sees it on her undergarments, if she sees it on a liner, sees it on white cotton, out of her body. We'll talk about bedikah cloth later. That's a separate thing. But if she sees it outside of her body, if it's smaller than a gris, she can ignore it. So now the criteria. The stain the woman sees, it has to be seen. It has to be a questionable color. It has to be bigger than a gris. It has to be on a material that's considered mekabel tuma. It's a much more complicated concept than I am able to explain, but basically it means it has to be seen on white cotton, paper, such as toilet paper. Paperish materials such as toilet paper or a liner are not mekabel tuma. So stains seen on paper materials are a different level of shiloh also. Okay, and then you have other things. Seen in the toilet bowl, and not necessarily. So there's a lot of other criteria, but those are the main criteria. The seeing it, the size, the color, the material it falls on, and of course, when in her cycle she sees it. So those of us who are taught as kalas to fear going to the bathroom, I'd like to apologize on behalf of your kala teacher. Don't be afraid to go to the bathroom. Don't be afraid to see something. Because many of the stains, and again, forgive me for being so vivid, and I apologize it's recorded, but so much of what a woman will see might not be nida. And I think what breaks...
It might also be normal. So
it's very normal, right. Medically very normal, yeah. Which is why when you call your doctor alarmed about staining, they're like, you're great, bye-bye. Like, because it's fine, because you're supposed to do that. But halachically, it is not alarming until you ask a shaila and until you learn. And that's the process of asking a shaila to your kala teacher, to someone on the hotline, to your rub, to understand and learn what it is that you're about. You don't need to know all the colors. Every woman's body is different. A woman only needs to know her own colors. So along the journey of life, when a woman sees stains, and as you will see, wherever you are in life, different life stages provide different colors and different new experiences, ask the question to learn what is relevant to you. So that's the stain. So those are the two categories. We have flow, which is timing, which is why, getting back to the birth control, that if a woman is double packing and she is on active pills, she's not expecting her period. And there are many post-game, and this is a little bit, might not be as well known, there are many post-game that feel, and that poskin, that active pills, reliable birth control, and we'll talk about how reliable birth control becomes reliable birth control pills will override her regular calendar days, her regular expectation of her period. So getting back to Martha's point, medically you can double pack, halachically you can take as many packs as you want. When it comes to the staining, if a woman sees that she's staining, it may or may not make her need it, depending on how much it is and how much she sees it and what the criteria are. But if she's on active pills, she's not expecting her period, and therefore it stays in the category of staining, and the shaila is applied there. The other thing, which we're going to briefly talk on because I want to move further, is the concept of calendar days. It's a small, big piece of the mitzvah that often gets lost. Thank God there's an app for it nowadays, so you can just sign into the app, put in your dates, and you don't have to think at all. But certainly when you double pack, it affects your calendar days. Some people call it veset. Those are the days of anticipation, when a woman is anticipating her period. Husband and wife are supposed to separate from intimacy that day. She's supposed to do a bedikah that day. There's a very intricate way of calculating what the separation days are based on when she previously had her period. We love apps. Get the app. Or you can call me, because I love math, so I'm happy to do it also. But that will be affected if a woman continuously double packs. So that's the other thing to keep in mind. Okay.
Perfect.
Okay. The next thing, Martha, we get a ton of, like I said, it's always about birth control. And as life goes on, no woman will handle one birth control her whole life. So as fast as you can you tell us about all the other amazing options out there? And I just, one disclaimer I forgot, it of course goes without saying that any couple using birth control, the decision to use birth control is a decision that is usually, of course, made between the couple and family planning, but also usually done in conjunction with a rav along the way. In halacha, it is appropriate for every couple to be in touch with a rav, their personal rav, for their own personal situation when embarking on birth control. So having said that, Martha, after the pill, what are the other many ways that I just learned about from Martha?
Perfect. So the pill in the textbook has what we call anywhere from a 93 to 99% efficacy, meaning it works for contraception. Why 93%? That sounds very low. And that is due to human error, because a pill requires you to take a pill every single day at the same time, which for a lot of people, that doesn't work for their lifestyle. So there are two other birth control options that work hormonally exact same way as the pill, but are delivered in different forms. And I think, especially in the firm community, there's a lot of underutilization of other options that are really great for the busy, running around, can't remember, take a pill at the same time every day kind of person. So one is called the NuvaRing. It's a silicone material ring. It looks like a circle, but it's squishy. And it's actually inserted vaginally, and it lives there for 21 days in a row. So it stays there for 21 days, set it and forget it. It is removed after 3 weeks, and then you allow for that withdrawal for 1 week where you get your period or your withdrawal bleed. And the same way that one can double, triple pack, you can double, triple ring if you wanted to. So in terms of the schedule, it's just a very user-friendly delivery option of the birth control pills that are taken orally. Another option, which
I forgot to say we're going to interrupt. We're going to move faster because I'm watching the time. The only issue with the NuvaRing to keep in mind is that if a woman is using a NuvaRing, it is a chatzitza when she uses the mikvah. So she will need to remove it briefly when she uses the mikvah and then reinsert it. And according to my medical director of the program, she said it is okay for those quick 20, 10, 15 minutes to have it removed and put it back in. Carry on.
Totally fine, yes. So similar to the NuvaRing, which although I would say is a little less user-friendly because everyone's body composition is so different, is something called a patch. It's a transdermal sticker that has the same hormones in it, the estrogen and progesterone. It's like a sticker that you stick somewhere on your body. Some people do it on their abdomen. Some people do it on their arm. It's supposed to be a centrally centrally located spot, and basically the hormones are absorbed through the skin. You change it once a week, so it's not 3 weeks, but it's once a week the patch is changed. And then the fourth week, no patch, you get a period. However, I will say with the patch, BMI makes a big difference, body fat composition makes a big difference, someone's skin sensitivity makes a big difference. So as far as everybody reacting differently to it and staining, by therefore that occurs with it, I find that staining is a little more common with the patch than with the oral pills or the ring. And then chatzitza, I would assume.
Is the same issue, exactly.
The difference with a patch is once you unstick something sticky, it's hard to stick back on, so it's hard to restick after the mikvah.
A little more coordination with you there.
Time. Again, I don't know that I would plug the patch as much as the ring. Okay, so next topic of options. There are people, for health reasons, or for family history reasons, or for the bad rap it gets on the street, reasons that want to avoid estrogen in their birth control pill. So there are progesterone-only methods that are great, A, for someone who cannot take estrogen. So I'll just talk very briefly. People who should not be on anything with estrogen is someone who has a history of high blood pressure, somebody who has a history of migraines with visual changes, somebody who is a smoker, or also someone who is breastfeeding should not be taking estrogen because estrogen can decrease milk supply. So there are progesterone-only methods that are effective for contraception. However, and they come in oral forms and non-oral forms. We'll talk about the oral ones first. The oral form that is most commonly prescribed, I would say, to my postpartum women or to the people that are on birth control while they're breastfeeding, it's called the mini pill. And basically, it's a very small dose of progesterone that when it's taken at the exact same time every single day within a two-hour window and not missed ever is effective for contraception with breastfeeding, which also can help with contraception, but I'm not going to go into that. So that's the progesterone-only mini pill. But something that a lot of people don't know, when you look at the pill pack, it's four rows of pills. So if you've been on birth control pills before, you might think, oh, I can double pack and skip my last week. Do not skip any pills. Do not forget to take the last week because it is just progesterone. It's the same dose every single day. There is no scheduled withdrawal bleed from a progesterone-only pill known as the mini pill. There's something newer on the market called Slind, which, if applies to you, talk to your medical provider. It is a progesterone-only pill with a different type of progesterone that's a lot more user-friendly because it has a 24-hour missed pill window. So that means if you're late more than a few hours, it still works, which is a perk if you're on it. And it also has 4 days at the end of the pack that are considered a placebo. So there is, in theory, a scheduled bleed, and you can skip those 4 days if you want to double pack and triple pack. So for health reasons and for people who have medical contraindications or who don't want to be on estrogen, those are oral options with progesterone that are utilized often.
Excellent. There's no real halachic, again, there's no halachic need to get a period. So if you're on the progesterone, not getting a period is great. We're going to run into IUDs, and we have 5 minutes left, so we're not going to go over. After we do IUDs, we're going to take our last three topics and motion real close, okay?
Okay, IUDs are very popular. Intrauterine device is what IUD stands for. It is a little T-shaped device that's inserted in your provider's office into the uterus. There are two families of IUDs, some that are progesterone only, so again, no estrogen. Great for breastfeeding, great for people who can't have estrogen, works for contraception, and one that are hormone-free. That one's made out of copper. As far as putting it in, it is not done in the operating room, typically without anesthesia. Put them in all the time. I tell people expect bad period cramps that day or two, but otherwise in terms of invasiveness and not very invasive procedure. And however, because the way the progesterone one works is it actually lives in the uterus, it thins the uterine lining, so it basically makes the uterine lining very thin. Many people, after being on an IUD for a lot of years, will not get a spontaneous period because there is nothing to shed. Other people will spot frequently all the time for 3 to 6 months, sometimes the whole time they're on it. Some people get their regular period through it. Some people don't get their regular period through it. And every body is different, and everyone's response to the IUD in their body will be different. And this is for the progesterone one. But I find that progesterone IUDs are very popular in my 45 to 55 age group because for medical reasons, they might want to be weaning themselves off of estrogen as the menopausal transition is happening, and they want effective birth control. If they're still cycling, they might still want to not get pregnant. But it can cause irregular bleeding throughout that whole chapter. And people sometimes ride that kind of through their menopausal transition, which we'll talk about.
Okay, so the highlights of an IUD situation, which, as Martha just explained, is one has great options medically. Number one, it's important to know the procedure to have an IUD put in and taken out does not cause NIDA. They do not open the cervix enough. The procedure itself, the instruments are small enough. The procedure itself does not cause NIDA. And the other reason for that is that initially the first few days after an IUD is put in, a woman might see staining, and halachically that staining is considered something called dam maka. She is seeing it in the area of interest. It's going to be concerning to her. It could be red. It could be this. But it's considered dam maka. Maka means a wound. Halacha acknowledges that sometimes a woman will see vaginal bleeding that is not uterine in source or not caused by cycle and not caused by shedding of the uterine lining. It's caused by a wound. And wound blood seen in that area does not cause NIDA. So for the first 2 days after an IUD, the procedure itself does not cause NIDA by most postgame, and the blood seen immediately afterwards for the first few days is considered dam maka. However, post a few days, a week, 2 weeks, as Martha said, a woman might continue staining for a long time, whether it be 3 months as medically often taught or longer. That blood might cause NIDA. That staining might cause NIDA. So the other thing to take away from an IUD placement is that the timing of it should be requested to be when a woman is not a NIDA. If she is a NIDA when she has an IUD placed, she might risk staying a NIDA for a long time and might have trouble getting through her Shev Nikiyim. If she has it placed once she's already been to the mikvah and she's out of her NIDA status, that staining will be able to be judged based on what we talked about earlier, the staining category. Okay, so that's mostly about IUD. Again, any questions, you can be in touch. Our next three topics, which we're going to do in the last 3 minutes, we had postpartum, we had medical procedures, and we had perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause.
If you want to go get lunch,
Halify,
you can go get
they
lunch.
They all go that fast, right? Okay, buddy, good health. Okay, Martha, I'm going to let you go for your three highlights of those three categories, and I will go with my three highlights afterwards of those three categories. Give me 1 second
okay.
together,
all
and
right.
then I will respond with the halachic issues at each point as she goes through the highlights of the medical.
Well, as far as postpartum goes, we tell all of our patients who deliver babies, either vaginally or C-section, that they will have bleeding and can have very normal bleeding, 6, sometimes up to 8 weeks postpartum. How long that lasts for each individual person is very different, but from a medical standpoint, if you call your doctor at 5.5 weeks and be like, I am still bleeding, what is wrong with me? I understand you want to get to the mikvah, that's very frustrating, and we can talk about that, but medically, we're not worried. Your uterus housed the baby for 9 months and now is slowly sloughing off all of the remnants of that. So bleeding for a long period of time, 6 to 8 weeks is, again, what I tell my patients, that can be really, really normal. And as far as the lucky ones who don't see any blood after 3.5 weeks, I would say, again, lucky. That being said, you might get 4 days, you know, of no blood, and you're, like, ready to start your, you know, bedikos and head to the mikvah, and then day 6, you have bleeding again, and it's not abnormal. So some people bleed straight 5-6 weeks. Some people stop after 3 weeks and then have 2 days here and 3 days here, and if the day that they walked up the stairs for the first time, have a little bit more there, that's all in the realm of normal postpartum.
So the answer to the postpartum halachic thing is that follow your body's lead, try your Hefsek Tahor and your Shev Nikiyim as soon as you feel comfortable, medically ready. Be aware of what the medical expectation is, and you can go to the mikvah as soon as a woman gets her Hefsek Tahor and her Shev Nikiyim. And as far as the 6-week mark of seeing your doctor and resuming relations and getting to the mikvah, halacha and medicine are all looking for the same thing, that the woman's body should heal. So if she can do her bediko clear, likely her body has healed. If she's seen her doctor and gotten the okay to resume relations, likely her body has healed. So the goal postpartum is for the body to heal.
I will just stress that there's a difference, I would say, from a medical standpoint of allowing a woman that I did not examine to do her bedikot. If she's not bleeding, she can certainly check and try to get to the mikvah. I would still recommend, until clearance from your provider, that you don't resume intercourse or insert anything larger vaginally than a bedikah cloth itself alone until after clearance from your doctor. So that's just something that there's a difference, and I don't know if you want to touch this now, but can you go to the mikvah without...
We're going to skip that. Yeah. If you have a shiloh, if you end up being able to go to the mikvah without seeing your doctor first, give a call. We'll talk about what those options are. Medical procedures, the two most common we're going to talk about are a pap smear and a DNC. The general rule about halacha medicine is talk to your doctor, talk to your medical provider, find out the name of the procedure, You don't need to ask what instruments are being used. Nowadays, rabbis can figure out what's happening in the procedure. Thank God everyone's well-educated now. Find out the name of the procedure that is happening, and this is true for all stages of life. Bring the name of the medical procedure to the shayla, and you will find out what needs to be done. The doctors are taking care of you physically. Halacha will take care of you halachically. But talk about a pap smear and a DNC and what they are.
Right. Very different things from each other.
Yes.
A pap smear is a screening test for cervical cancer. So essentially, it's a little brush that's brushed on the cervix, not in the uterus, not inside the uterus, on the outside of the cervix, which is at the back of the vaginal canal. So a little brush that gets sent, a little piece, some cells come off, not painful. I plug everyone to get pap smears. Cells come off, get sent to pathology, and it's a screening test to see if the cells are growing normal or abnormal, or if a woman is at risk for developing cervical cancer. It has nothing to do with how many sexual partners, or Jews or non-Jews, or from people or not from people alike. The screening for cervical cancer is something that is really, really important among all women. And guidelines have recently changed that a pap smear is only recommended once every 3 years if they're normal. There's some ramifications with that. But again, something that we should see your provider annually. You might not get a pap smear annually, and that's okay. However, the cervix sometimes can be a little bit finicky. And when we brush the outside of the cervix, sometimes there is some bleeding. When you go home and you see bleeding, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm bleeding. What am I going to do? I will tell you from a medical perspective, that bleeding is never coming from inside the uterus. It is cervical bleeding. So what does that mean?
So first of all, that alone is enough why the stain doesn't cause NIDA. But now you know. It's unexpected. It's not your flow. It's done from a procedure. It could be considered done maca. It's a tiny bit. A woman's going to see it on a liner. She's going to wear a liner that day. The highlight to think ahead is that if a woman can schedule her pap smear not during her Shevaneh Kiyum because she's going to not want to insert a bedikel cloth right after the pap smear, she should schedule it not during her Shevaneh Kiyum, ideally, because if she does bedika, she's going to see the stain on the bedikel cloth. It's going to be a problem. Schedule when it's not your Shevaneh Kiyum. If a woman scheduled it 6 months ago, it happens to be your Shevaneh Kiyum, she can't change the appointment. Do a bedika in the morning before you go to the doctor's appointment, and then be in touch with someone about what to do with the second bedika that day. If it's in the middle, if it could be avoided, that would help not making that stain a NIDA. So there are ways to have a pap smear and not become the pap smear process does not cause NIDA. And the staining afterwards also does not cause NIDA. If a woman were to insert a white cotton thing into the vaginal canal after that, that could cause NIDA. So don't do that. But the pap smear itself and wearing a liner afterwards and a regular routine pap smear does not cause NIDA.
Okay, very briefly with a DNC. This is probably one of the most common gynecologic procedures, typically done in the operating room under some anesthesia. It is a treatment for women who have unfortunately gone through any miscarriage that is not expelled spontaneously, or a treatment for someone later in life who's having abnormal bleeding, sometimes growths on the inside of the uterus, that need to be removed. So essentially, a woman is under light sedation, and the uterus is dilated a drop, and then curettage, which basically means suctioned out all the abnormality that's in there, whether it be remnants of an early miscarriage or something medically going on. So we talked a little bit about the IUD insertion procedure, how the opening of the uterus at that point is not enough to render someone a NIDA.
But a DNC is different. Does cause NIDA. Again, I don't even know the specifics of it, but a DNC does cause NIDA between the amount it's open. And even though it could be considered there's a lot of damaka going on, the truth is it gets very gray, so to speak, which part of the shedding is the maca and which part of the shedding is actually the shedding of the uterine lining. So a DNC will almost always cause NIDA. Again, ask for your own situation if it comes up. And moving into perimenopause, menopause, postmenopause.
All in one sentence.
Tell us what happens, tell us what to expect, and tell us what's normal, tell us what's not normal. Okay. Best way to handle it. Thanks.
So, no problem. I will say the average age in the United States right now of a woman's transition to menopause is 51 and a half. And what that means is that 50% of people are menopausal before they are 51, and 50% of people are menopausal after. So as you can see, that transition stage is a very wide window. What typically happens physically, as your body's natural estrogen stores are depleting, is you may have cycles that are looking irregular. Some people get a period for many, many years every 28 days or with a pack of some sort of manipulation with a very scheduled pattern, and then all of a sudden they're like, haven't had a period in 3 months. And then they have a period, and it's like a 10-day period. And then they have no period for 6 months, and then they have 3 weeks straight of bleeding. Or then they will have, again, a lot of irregular. I always say the fire gets worse before it goes out, so that is very, very, very common in the menopausal transition as far as bleeding patterns go. So for those that are on an estrogen-containing birth control method who are over 50, a lot of the providers will probably want to wean you off your exogenous or extra estrogen at that stage, because there is a risk of putting more estrogen into your body when your body is no longer making its own estrogen. So for a lot of people who are very happy on their contraception, this is kind of like an uprooting moment. We're like, well, you're going to pull me off the pill, and then what's going to happen with my period, and what am I going to expect? And so that's a conversation to have with your doctor, because there are a lot of great transition options that are safe because they don't contain estrogen, but also that can be ridden through the menopausal transition. And I think the last piece that I want to talk about this transition is that it comes usually, some people notice it because of the bleeding pattern changes, and some people notice it because of symptoms. So there are symptoms that occur as our bodies are naturally depleting themselves of estrogen, and those are called vasomotor symptoms of menopause, and they often are hot flashes, so feeling very hot and sweaty for no reason during the day, at random periods of the day. Sometimes it's night sweats, sometimes it's insomnia, so trouble sleeping. Sometimes it's vaginal dryness when that was never an issue. So these are all things medically that happen as a woman is transitioning into her menopausal years. And those symptoms are actually treatable with this concept called hormone replacement therapy. So a lot of people are suffering as they kind of go through menopause. It is not that post-menopause all hormones are evil, but it has to be prescribed in a very safe and effective way by a doctor who's familiar, or a nurse practitioner who's familiar in managing these symptoms. And because you're replacing hormones, and then let's say you miss a pill, or you're late on your patch, or late on something else, you could also have staining due to the hormones, which again might render a Shiloh at that stage in life.
So all I have to add to that is that after years of not hearing from people, this is the stage we hear from people again. We are here to answer your questions. Just bring your Shiloh. It is chaotic. We're here to help you, here to support you. And then you had one really important point about post-menopause, and then we're going to go to lunch. Yeah, what was your last thing about
the last plug for post-menopause is that the definition of menopause is no spontaneous periods for 12 months. So congratulations, you've made it 12 months with no spontaneous bleeding. You are now menopausal. Bleeding post-menopause is never normal. So if you have spontaneous bleeding, a little brown, a little schmutz, a little red, you didn't just randomly get a period. You need to see your medical provider, because the only thing we worry about post-menopause as a response to abnormal bleeding is like uterine cancer. So this is something that is very, very, very important not to ignore. And bleeding after 1 year of no bleeding is never something to ignore. Please come see me, come see anyone, take care of your health.
And the general rule also is that if you see something you're unexpected, call your doctor first, call your nurse first, and then call Halachic, and we'll figure out what the status is. Thank you all for joining us today. Sorry about taking your lunch. We apologize.